So we're in James chapter 4 this morning. Let's go ahead and turn there with me. James chapter 4, we're going to be down to verses 13, going into chapter 5, all the way down to verse 6. So you remember when James gave us the outline for his letter, back in verse 19, he said to be quick to listen, which we know is about obedience, be slow to speak, which he addressed to teachers, but also just how we use our tongue in general, and then lastly, to be slow to wrath or slow to anger, and that's been chapters 4 and 5, and so we started that last week. Now, all last week was about the quarrels and the fighting and the bickering that was taking place within the church or churches. We don't know if there's more than one house church there, but at least one. And so he was approaching and dealing with that last week, all of the infighting that they were having and some of their bad behavior, if you will. And what we're going to look at this morning is sort of a continuation of that, because again, it's all the way through chapters 4 and 5, and even next week will be a continuation, and the following week will be a continuation as he works through this thread. Now, we saw last week that there was a bunch of infighting, and among James' readers, and part of what was causing some of that infighting, if you remember, was the tension between the rich and the poor. And so, much like most churches, the body of Christ is a mixture. There are some that are wealthy, and there are some that are poor, and there are some that are somewhere in between. And we know that there was conflict in the church or churches that James was writing to, because we already saw earlier that there was some favoritism that was going on. You remember how some would come into the church with the gold rings and the fine clothes, it says, and some in the church would see them come in and immediately invite them, hey, just have the best seats in the house here, you know? And then somebody else would come in ragged clothes, and they would basically say, well, I guess you can sit here on the floor next to where I put my feet. And so there was favoritism going on within the church. He also has to address the rich and how they're treating the poor, and we're going to see some of that today. And so we know that there was tension there, some abuse that was taking place between the wealthy and the not so wealthy. So there's bad behavior going on, essentially. As we come to our passage, that passage today, as James kind of moves from that general concept of quarrels and conflicts and the instructions that he gave and how to deal with that, he's going to now specifically target some individuals in the church. And most of this passage today targets the wealthy, targets those who are better off. Now, it doesn't mean that he doesn't have some issues with those who weren't. In fact, he's already accused them of playing favorites, right? It was those who were probably middle income or poor that were favoring the rich, trying to cater up to them and maybe get something. So he's already sort of dealt with that. But he comes out of the gate here, and this is probably, in this letter, probably the most pointed James gets. And so we're going to break it down today into two sections. James rebukes some in the church for their arrogant and boastful pursuit of wealth. So that's how he's going to start. He's going to rebuke some of these people because of their arrogant and boastful pursuit of wealth. From there, he then warns them, probably the same people, we're not exactly sure, but probably the same people, he warns them of the judgment that they would face because of how they acquired their wealth. So those are the two basic sections we're going to look at today. So let's look at the first one. It's in verses 13 to 17. James rebukes some of the readers for their arrogant and boastful pursuit of wealth. Look at verses 13 through 17 of chapter 4. Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to such and such a city and spend a year there and engage in business and make a profit. Yet you do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. You are just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away. Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and also do this or that. But as it is, you boast in your arrogance. All such boasting is evil. Therefore, to the one who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, to him it is sin. Now, let me ask you a question. Does the Bible condemn being wealthy or having a lot of stuff?
No.
No. The Bible doesn't ban wealth, doesn't say we shouldn't have wealth, doesn't say we shouldn't ever be rich. In fact, if you go in the Old Testament, what you find out is that oftentimes wealth was a blessing from the Father, right? Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Joseph were all wealthy. It was part of their relationship with God. God made them prosperous. We saw that with Isaac, how everything he touched made he was prosperous in it. Even Laban saw that he was profitable because of somebody else, right? Same thing with Joseph. Everything Joseph did, God made him a success in that. And he became the second highest official in all the land of Egypt. So sometimes financial blessings come from God. So if it were wrong to be wealthy, we've got a problem. But does the Bible ever warn us about the pursuit of that? Can anybody think of any passages? Matthew 6:1. Can you read that to us? Or can you even summarize it?
No one can serve two masters, for either he will hate the one and love the other, or he will be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and money.
Yeah. So Jesus himself says that we can't serve both God and money. Can't do it. Luke chapter 12. Jesus said, you can look this up on your own if you want to, but Luke chapter 12, verse 15. Actually, you know, let's do that. Let's go to this. Luke chapter 12, we'll look at the broader passage, Luke chapter 12, to get the fuller context of this. Luke 12, starting in verse 13. Someone in the crowd said to him, "Teacher, tell my brother to divide the family inheritance with me." In other words, I need to get what's coming to me. But he said to him, "Man, who appointed me judge or arbitrator over you?" Then he said, "Beware and be on your guard against every form of greed. For not even when one has an abundance does his life consist of his possessions." And he told him a parable saying, the land of a rich man was very productive. And he began reasoning to himself, saying, "What shall I do since I have no place to store my crops?" Then he said, "This is what I will do. I will tear down my barns and build larger ones, and there I will store all my grain and my goods. And I will say to my soul, 'Soul, you have many goods laid up for many years to come. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry.' But God said to him, 'You fool, this very night your soul is required of you, and now who will own what you have prepared?' So is a man who stores up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God." And he said to his disciples, "For this reason I say to you, do not worry about your life or what you will eat, nor your body as to what you will put on. For life is more than food and the body more than clothing. Consider the ravens, for they neither sow nor reap. They have no storehouses nor barn, and yet God feeds them. How much more valuable are you than the birds?" So basically, Jesus warns here about greed. Now, is it wrong for this man to desire that he receive part of the inheritance that culturally should have come to him? Jesus doesn't condemn that itself. What he condemns is this man that comes to him and says, "Hey, Jesus, you better make sure that I get what's coming to me." And Jesus understood what was in this man's heart. This man is storing up treasures in heaven. That's where his focus was. Focus is on getting what belongs to me. You know, Amy and I, Amy's mom is still around. My mom is still around. Is there some hope that when they pass on, there's something left that they might be able to pass on to their children? Well, of course. There's always that hope. I hope that someday when we die, we'll be able to pass something along to our children. So that's not wrong, but the pursuit, especially when it's a form of greed, we've seen, I know people whose families have been destroyed because when their parents die, the bickering and the fighting among the children over what they get out of that inheritance and what they deserve. And we've always told my mom, and I think Connie would understand this too, we're like, "You know what, if you guys just are dead broke and leave us with nothing, we're okay with that. It's your money, you use it. We didn't earn that. It doesn't belong to us." That'll tear families apart when that happens. We've got a situation right now where a friend of my mom's, one of her closest friends, when her husband died, my dad's best friend, her daughter convinced her to sell everything and to move to Eau Claire, Wisconsin. They bought this big house. They put her in this big house. They started charging her, I think it was around $2,000 for rent in Eau Claire, Wisconsin. And they've controlled her finances and manipulated her finances, and we're now concerned that they've been taking advantage of that. They really bought the house so that they might have an investment, and now she's paying for that house for them, and it gives them a place to store all their toys. And it's just created some real problems within that family and the mother-daughter relationship and everything else. Greed. So Jesus condemns that. So while the Bible doesn't condemn wealth, it certainly condemns greed and the pursuit of wealth, as Matt has pointed out here through Jesus. You can't serve both God and money. There's just no way to do it. You're going to love one and hate the other. That's what Jesus said. 1 Timothy chapter 6, verse 9 and 10. Paul wrote, "Those who want to get rich fall into temptation and a snare and many foolish and harmful desires which plunge men into ruin and destruction. For the love of money is a root of all sorts of evil. And some, by longing for it, have wandered away from the faith and pierced themselves with many griefs." Man, we could spend a day on that alone, couldn't we? Essentially, if you want to get rich, if that's your pursuit, there's snares, temptations, harmful desires. It'll plunge you into ruin and destruction. It may cause you to wander away from the faith. May pierce yourself with many griefs. I mean, Paul's pretty clear there. So we know what the Bible says, right? Some of James' readers weren't heeding the warnings that we just read. Look back again at verse 13. He starts off, "Come now, you who say, today or tomorrow we will go to such and such a city and spend a year there and engage in business and make a profit." Now, there's obviously nothing wrong with making a profit. In fact, Proverbs chapter 21 says, verse 5 says, "The plans of the diligent lead surely to profit." That's an encouragement. If you're diligent, it can lead to a profit. But everyone who is hasty comes surely to poverty. The Old Testament encouraged good, hard work as a way of generating a profit, making money, caring for your family, building an estate. So what we see here, the problem isn't that they were making plans here. If this were simply the rich saying, okay, we got to figure this out. Let's get together, guys. Let's talk about how we're going to make our next, you know, profit. Maybe we'll start a business here. That's not what they're doing. If we just had verse 13 all by itself, we might think that. But look at what it says when you move on. "Yet you do not know what your life will be like tomorrow. You are just a vapor that appears for a little while and then vanishes away." They were thinking they're going to be around forever. They didn't realize that life is fragile. So they had forgotten that. But look what else. Verse 15. "Instead, you ought to say, if the Lord wills, we will live and also do this or that." These men weren't just simply discussing business matters. Again, the Old Testament tells us that if we're diligent, okay, we should. I mean, I do this all the time. I think about my family and how I'm going to take care of my family, how I'm going to pay the bills. Chris and I, we just discussed this morning. You know, bills keep coming in. The Bible tells us you have to be diligent, right? That's not what they were doing. They had forgotten, they were somewhat... they forgot that their lives are like a vapor, as James already says in the beginning in chapter 1. But what else did they forget here? Look back again at verse 15. What did they choose to exclude from their plans? Or who did they choose to exclude from their plans? What? Yeah. "You ought to instead say, if the Lord wills, we will live and also do this or that." Earlier, James in chapter 1, verse 9, said that the rich were to humble themselves or to glory in their humble position instead of glorying in their wealth, their high position. Notice that what he does in verse 16 is he gives us a picture as to what they were actually doing. This was not just business planning. Notice he says in verse 16, "But as it is, you boast in your arrogance, and all such boasting is evil." So that colors what happens in verse 13. These men weren't just getting together and saying, "Hey guys, let's see if we can come up with some business plans." You know, Matt's involved with a purchase, meaning the company's purchased his company. There's a lot of planning that goes into that, isn't there? How things are going to work out. That's okay. It should be that way. If you don't do that, you're going to fail miserably. But it tells us here that they weren't just doing that. They were boasting. So when you reread verse 13, this is probably them boasting to others in the church. "Hey, we're going to go to this city or that city. We're going to make all this money and look at us." They were boasting, he says, in their arrogance. Have you ever known anybody that's that way? Always talking about the money they're making. Always talking about the success of the business. Always. It's a form of bragging. It's a form of boasting. And James says, it's arrogance. Even calls it evil. Tells them, your life's like a vapor. It could be gone tomorrow. Isn't that what Jesus said when we read the passage earlier in Luke? He's like, you don't realize. Your life's a vapor. You could be gone tomorrow. In fact, the book of Ecclesiastes, there's a statement in there where he basically says, hey, life is vain because you build all this stuff up and you die and some dude who didn't work for it gets your stuff. Oh, that is vanity, isn't it? Spend your whole life building this massive wealth and it goes to some guy who just didn't do anything to deserve it. Because that's the way life is, right? And so that's what James is doing here. Their plans should have focused on what God wanted. In fact, that's actually what's being implied here. It isn't just that they forgot God, it's that they were not seeking. When you hear this phrase, if the Lord wills, we will do this or that, we can interpret that one of two ways. One is, God, I've got all these big plans, I want to do all this stuff, and if it's your will that that happens, then great. That's one way to interpret that. I don't think that's wrong to interpret it that way. But another way to understand this is to say, Lord, what do you want me to do? And to start with that. Not, here's my plans, Lord, and I'll do that if you want that. The other is, starting from not my plans, but what are your plans, Lord? If it's your will, what would we do? What should we do? What do you want me to do? Now again, I think both of those are valid. Because I think God gives us gifts and abilities and skills and certainly He uses those things. And we should ask. We should say, Lord, this is what I'm thinking. This is what I'd like to do. But I want to know if it's your will that I do that. I think it's appropriate. But that's not really where it should end, because we should be also asking the question, Lord, what do you want from me? Because maybe it has nothing to do with my will. Have any of you ever been in a position like that before where you thought about doing something or you wanted to do something and then you ultimately discovered God did that was not His plan at all? Yeah. But if we don't ask the question. And so I think James has more in mind there. I think he has that second one probably in mind. If the Lord wills, that's what you ought to ask. If the Lord wants this, that's what we'll do. Verse 17, he says, therefore, to one who knows the right thing to do and does not do it, to him it is sin. That's a summary statement. What would be the right thing to do in this context? Verse 17. Since it follows right on the heels of if the Lord wills, I think what he's saying is, you know the right thing to do. You ought to be asking the Lord. You ought to be looking for the Lord. You ought to be seeking the Lord's will, not your own. That's the right thing to do. And if you don't do that, he calls it sin. Does that sting a little bit? We always think of sin as when we do something wrong, it's sin, right? But the Bible also makes it really clear that not to do the right thing can also be sin. So not acting can be sin as well. Sometimes we refer to that as a sin of omission. There's a sin of commission. You committed a sin, but then when you don't do what you should do, that's a sin of omission. You've omitted it. And so when we look at these individuals, they had forgotten, again, another Old Testament principle. I love this because so much of what James does here, remember, he's a Jew, and he's writing to Jewish people, Hebrews. And so much of the concepts that he's talking about here, that he's highlighting, come directly out of the Old Testament. In fact, Proverbs, I'll read these, 16 verse 9, the mind of a man plans his ways, but what? The Lord does what? Directs his steps. Proverbs 19:21, many plans are in a man's heart, but the counsel of the Lord is what stands. That's an Old Testament principle. You can make plans, you can have your hearts, or you can have your desires and that, but ultimately it comes down to God is going to accomplish what God wants, and we need to keep that in mind. So they made their plans. Would have been nothing wrong with just making those plans, but they were boasting about them. They were arrogant and proud. They forgot to include God in those plans. They weren't apparently seeking what God wanted, but rather they were seeking and pursuing wealth. And we've already seen how the Lord condemns that. In fact, our takeaway, I think, for this is that Jesus told us not to store up treasures on earth, did he not? He said, don't store up treasures on earth, store up treasures in heaven. Turn to Matthew chapter 6. Matthew chapter 6. Jump down to verse 19. Jesus said, do not store up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy. James is going to use that analogy in a minute. Again, he's taking so much right from the words of Jesus and from the Old Testament. Do not store up treasures for yourself on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But store up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be. Where your treasure is, there your heart will be. Why can't you serve God and money? Why can't you pursue wealth as your ultimate goal in life? Because that's where your heart will be. Because that's where your treasure is. You can't make that your life goal at the exclusion of God and have it not affect your heart. Your heart's going to follow the treasure. And so I think, you know, maybe you don't fall into this category. Maybe you're not out there boasting about how much you're worth or what you've made. But is there an element of, I still pursue that? That's kind of where my heart is. That's kind of where my treasure is. That's the challenge for us. I struggle sometimes because obviously my hope is that Amy and I someday might be able to retire and not become a burden to our children and have to care for us. But there's a desire sometimes to want to have enough to where we can do some things and travel all over the place and have some nice things too. And again, not necessarily wrong, but sometimes that preoccupies my heart. When I see the stock market puke, it gets frustrating, you know. I sent a text to Matt and Dustin yesterday. A death by a thousand cuts. You know what that is? Sometimes, you know, you want one really big cut because then it's done, but then you can have the death by a thousand little cuts, and that seems to be worse sometimes. So I was just sharing with them. I'm like, you know, the number of things that have broken around my house that have cost me money in the last month alone? We've had a microwave tray that just, we were heating something up and heard this bang, and we looked in the microwave tray, the glass tray had split right in half. And I'm like, oh, you know, so go online, okay, drop $80 on that, you know. And then we had Amy broke her glasses, and I was like, oh, we got to do that now, you know. And then the water in the bathroom before we left for Christmas leaked. and cost us 300 and some odd bucks to get a plumber out there that morning to do it. You know, so I'm like, really? You got to do that? You know, and then the van door's now acting up. We're like, oh, we got to put money into that. Well, yesterday my snowblower gave up the ghost. So I had to drop $1,000 on getting a new snowblower. After I spent $50 on a new carburetor that didn't fix it, that I now can't return. And in my head I'm going, you know what, Lord, I'm going to get, this is like death by a thousand financial cuts, you know? And I just had to stop and go, what's that? Oh, in the front door when Kimberly was leaving right after Christmas, she walked out, the wind caught the front door and literally destroyed the plunger. So I had to go online, and I think that was another $80 or $90 to get that, you know. And so I look at it, all the, oh, plus there was the washing machine that about a month ago here, just the beginning of that, broke, and we ended up having that fixed for $300. And so I'm starting to go, you know, I'm adding up all this, I'm looking at like $2,500 or $2,500 for all this in the last month alone, and I'm going, Lord, I'm going to go broke. You know, it just consumes our heart, doesn't it? I got nothing to worry about. God's provided the funds to take care of us as a family. We work for a living, you know. But it's interesting how those little things just consume us, right? And that's where your heart is now. Well, Jesus already said, well, don't worry about it. We'll take care of it. And so yesterday, as I was thinking through some of this stuff, I'm like, it's interesting because I think mankind might be the only species, if you will, God's only creation, that has to really like work to provide. The rest of the animal kingdom, I mean, they forage for food, but they don't go out and plant gardens. When was the last time you saw a squirrel in your backyard have to plant a nut garden? But I mean, they don't. They don't harvest. It's just sort of like they go out and they do that, right? But it's not like they're out there and you go, oh, that's the squirrel's little plot of land out there, and I see him out there with a little toe thing. You know, it doesn't happen that way, right? The deer in Worthington, they come and eat your stuff rather than their own, right? But it consumes our heart sometimes with that. And so James, as he's looking at what's happening in their church, there were some individuals in his church that were consumed, if you will, with their profit, with wealth. And they had forgotten that their lives are like a vapor. They had forgotten what Jesus had taught. They'd forgotten what the Old Testament taught about wealth and the pursuit of wealth and the dangers and the entrapment of wealth. They forgot to include God in those plans. But even beyond that, it doesn't sound like they were seeking God's will for their lives. Maybe some of them were, you know, God, well, okay, you know, this is what I really want to do. Can I get your blessing on this, you know? And so that's the first challenge we see from this passage, is that that pursuit can destroy us. Jesus has told us that's where our heart will be if that's what we do. Paul has told Timothy, this is going to destroy us if that's our pursuit. It's a form of greed is all it is. So again, not wrong to desire to make money and to build a business or to have a profit and to be able to save for retirement if you can, or to enjoy some nice things. The Bible doesn't condemn that. But it does condemn the pursuit of that, the pursuit if it involves greed. We refer to that sometimes as an idol of the heart. You worship that. So that's the challenge. Now, from there he goes on and he's going to get even a little bit more pointed than what he was there. And it appears that he's probably referring to the same individuals. Those that he addressed here in verse 13 through 17, it's possible they could have been middle income, if you want to call it that were doing this. Most likely the wealthy. But I can't say that absolutely for sure. It was definitely people who were greedy and were pursuing that. But now in chapter 5, he comes right out and tells us who he's going to address, because he calls them the rich. So again, I think it's probably the same group of people, but can't absolutely guarantee that. But here, he warns them of the judgment that they would face for how they acquire that wealth. James' readers, again, were Hebrews. James was a Hebrew, a Jew. They should have been aware of what the Old Testament said about profit made through wicked means. When we were raising the kids, what we used to love to do is to... And I know, they always say, you know, don't eat your meals in front of the TV as a family, just sit in the kitchen, whatever it is, right? Well, we decided, no, we're gonna sit in the family room, we're gonna watch TV as we ate together, but we would buy like older TV series. And so Gilligan's Island and some of those, well, kids fell in love with Gomer Pyle. And one of my favorite lines from Gomer Pyle was this phrase when he would say, "That's ill-gotten gains." I'm like, "Ill-gotten gains?" But he said it on multiple shows, "Ill-gotten gains." You know, and that was just wrong. And so when Gomer Pyle would see somebody acquiring something through improper means, he would call it out as ill-gotten gains. And stupid me, I didn't realize that that did come right out of the scriptures. And there were things, I mean, you could see with it, it wasn't a Christian series, but you could see that they tried to portray Gomer Pyle as a religious individual to some degree, and having a moral fabric to him. And so what's interesting is that comes right out of the scriptures. In fact, if you've got a King James, it'll probably say it. I think the NASB does as well. But turn to Proverbs chapter 10, verse 2. Proverbs chapter 10, verse 2. Yeah, it does right here in my NASB. Ill-gotten gains do not profit, but righteousness delivers from death. Ill-gotten gains. Essentially, that refers to things that are acquired through inappropriate measures, bad behavior. Look at Proverbs 13:11. Proverbs 13:11. Wealth obtained by fraud, that's ill-gotten gains, dwindles, but the one who gathers by labor increases it. Turn to Proverbs 21:6. The acquisition of treasures by a lying tongue is a fleeting vapor, the pursuit of death. The Old Testament is filled with that very principle, that finances, wealth, things should not be acquired by fraud or by inappropriate means. Condemns it. So you would think that James' readers, being Jews, would have understood that. But instead, James has to issue a warning to them. So he does this by leveling, or he starts by giving them a warning, and then he kind of levels three charges against them, which tells us what they were doing. That warning comes in verses 1 through 3. Look at that. "Come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries which are coming upon you. Your riches have rotted and your garments have become moth-eaten. Your gold and your silver have rusted, and their rust will be a witness against you and will consume your flesh like fire. It is in these last days that you have stored up your treasure." So what's the warning there? Look at how he starts out. Weep and howl. The words that he used there describe this loud, bitter, and desperate wailing, much like you would see at a funeral or a wake. The word miseries there refers to a wretched state. I think the Septuagint translates it as destruction. So he starts out with this pretty staunch warning. Weep, howl for your miseries which are coming upon you, your destruction which is coming upon you. And you notice that he ultimately talks about where that's going to occur. We'll get to that in a second. Notice he says that their riches have become worthless. Remember what he said back in chapter 2, verse 2? Chapter 2, verse 2. "If a man comes into your assembly with gold ring and dressed in fine clothing, so these men would come in with their gold on their fingers and their really fancy clothes, they would come into church. And look at what he says here. "Your gold and your silver have rusted, and their rust will be a witness against you, and they will consume your flesh like fire." But notice he says up in verse 2, "The riches have rotted and your garments have become moth-eaten." Think James maybe had those people in mind that come in with the rings on their fingers. Like, look at that ring on your finger there. That's going to turn to rust. Now we know gold doesn't rust, but we get the point, right? He says those fancy fine clothes you're wearing, those are going to become moth-eaten. So he kind of turns this on his head. He has these people in mind. He says ultimately that these things would witness, verse 3, against you. We all know what that means, don't we? You know what a witness is? It's the evidence against you for something. He says that they would consume their flesh like fire in the last days. Now, last days there, I believe, is obviously a reference to what happens in the future here. Revelation chapter 20, go ahead and turn there with me. Revelation chapter 20. Look at verse 11 through 15. We call this the Great White Throne Judgment. Happens after the thousand-year reign is done with Christ, before we ultimately enter into eternity. There's this event that takes place where every living human being will have to stand before Christ. And look what happens. Then I saw a great white throne and him who sat on it, that's Christ, and whose presence earth and heaven fled away, and no place was found for them. And I saw the dead, the great and the small, standing before the throne, and books were opened, and another book was opened, which is the book of life. And the dead were judged from the things which were written in the books, according to their deeds. The sea gave up the dead which were in it, and death and Hades gave up the dead which were in them, and they were judged, every one of them, according to their deeds. Then death and Hades were thrown into the lake of fire. This is the second death, the lake of fire. And anyone's name was not found written in the book of life, he was thrown into the lake of fire. That's the final judgment. That's what James has in mind. And he basically says, you rich, because of what you've done, should be fearful. You should mourn and weep and howl because of the misery, the destruction that you will face because of how you've earned your wealth. He's foreshadowing what would take place at the Great White Throne Judgment, I believe. And I think as they're standing there, the gold would be corroded, whatever. Their fine clothes will no longer be fine linen. It'll be moth-eaten, torn and tattered. And that'll be all the evidence that God needs to condemn them. That's the evidence of their deeds. It's right there in front of them. So it gives a pretty staunch warning. You notice the irony that James uses there? They were storing up treasures, but ultimately the only treasures that they'll have are the misery and the judgment that they face. James is using some irony here in describing what's taking place. So that's the warning. What are the charges against them? He gives us three things. Three things that they were guilty of. The first one is found in verse 4. Behold, the pay of the laborers who mowed your fields and which has been withheld by you cries out against you, and the outcry of those who did the harvesting has reached the ears of the Lord of the Sabbath. That's the phrase Lord of hosts. It's from the Old Testament. It's not Sabbath meaning Sunday. It's Sabbath is the word for hosts there. So essentially, they were withholding the wages of their workers. They weren't paying them. Leviticus 19:13 says, you shall not oppress your neighbor nor rob him. The wages of a hired man are not to remain with you through the night until morning. In other words, pay him what you owe him. Deuteronomy 24, verses 14 and 15. You shall not oppress a hired servant who is poor and needy, whether he is one of your countrymen or one of your aliens who is in your land and your towns. You shall give him his wages on this day before the sun sets, for he is poor and sets his heart on it, so that he will not cry against you to the Lord and it become a sin to you. The Bible, Old Testament, condemned not paying your laborers. They should have known that. Again, these were Hebrews being written to by a Hebrew surrounded by other Hebrews. They should have known the Old Testament. They should have known what it said. And yet here they are, James says, withholding the wages from those they had hired to do their work. That's the first accusation. The second accusation is they were living lives of self-indulgence. Look at the next indulgence. Look at the next verse. You have lived luxuriously on the earth and led a life of wanton pleasure. You have fattened your hearts in the day of slaughter. There's dozens. We'll get there in a second. The word luxurious means to live for pleasure. It's the word for licentiousness, to carouse. Wanton pleasure. What does that come to mind when you think of wanton pleasure? It's not wanton soup, by the way. Yeah, it comes from the idea of wanting, right? Excessive indulgence. in one's own desires. Excessive indulgence is another way to say that. Look at that word picture he used. You have fattened your hearts in the day of slaughter. That comes right out of the Old Testament system. What do you do before you sacrifice something? You fatten it up. And they have fattened themselves up, made themselves in many respects a sacrifice in a bad way for the day of slaughter. Again, I think a reference to the Great White Throne Judgment. So not only did they withhold the wages of those who were working for them, but they were living these lives of self-indulgence, wanton pleasure. And again, James is not condemning here having a nice life. He's not condemning having luxury. Again, the Bible doesn't condemn that. David and Solomon lived in luxury. But in this particular instance, the idea here that James is presenting is that's what their pursuit was, and that's how they were living. And they were living that way off the backs of the people who were working for them. Their luxury, their things, their wealth had come because they had ripped off the people that were working for them. The fraud, the lying, the deceit. The last thing they were guilty of, verse 6, you have condemned and put to death the righteous man. He does not resist you there. Righteous man likely is a reference to those laborers that he just talked about. It says they didn't even resist what the wealthy were doing to them. They didn't fight back. What do you make of the word murder there? That's the second time in this book that murder is mentioned. Some see that as purely symbolic. Do you think it's symbolic? The last place we saw that was in chapter 4, verse 2, where it says that they were bickering and fighting. It says, you lust and do not have, so you what? Commit murder. Here it says that they had condemned and put to death, murdered the righteous man. Now, can I be dogmatic about this? No, but I think he's talking there about murder. Or at least putting somebody to death. The Old Testament said that you were not allowed to withhold the wages from the poor man because he needed that money, the text says, to survive, to live. Back in Paul's day, back in James' day, they didn't have the systems like we do. They couldn't go out and get food stamps. There wasn't Medicaid or Medicare. They had to rely on the church family to care for them. And right here in the church, those with the wealth were hoarding it for themselves, taking advantage of the poor. So I think by what he's actually hinting at here is condemning and putting to death, I think he's basically saying, because of what you're doing, some don't have what they need, and you're responsible for their death. So I take it in a literal sense here. Again, I can't be dogmatic about that. But either way, it's not good, is it? And so he accuses them of these three things here. Withholding wages, living these lives of luxury, and then condemning and putting to death those who worked for them, those who were righteous, those who did not resist. That's a pretty damning statement, isn't it? It's not a pretty picture. So what do we do with that? I think one of our takeaways for this is it's pretty clear that the Bible condemns taking advantage of others for our own benefit. That's clear in the Old Testament. That's clearly what James is saying here. He condemns those who were pursuing their wealth on the backs of others and not paying them what they had promised to pay them. Not paying them what they owed. I tell you, when I was reading through this, we had a roof repair done back in, I think it was October. The guy came out immediately. It was a small company close to us. I never heard of him before, but it was a recommendation we had received. And he just came out. He took care of us right away. The ceiling above, he'd come through the ceiling in Katie's bedroom. And so I was waiting for an invoice to come from him. It was supposed to be like $500. We did it all through text. But didn't get the invoice. And so I kept waiting. I kept waiting for the invoice. And it just never came. And I think I mentioned it to Amy a little while back, like I still haven't got an invoice from that guy, and I meant to text him and say, hey, I never got the invoice, but somehow I thought I did, but apparently I didn't. So yesterday, as I was just reviewing this, I came to that, and I'm kind of like, I don't think I ever paid the guy for fixing my roof. And one of the first thoughts in my head was, he didn't invoice me, he must not care all that much. And I felt this incredible amount of shame, thinking, wait a minute, he did the work, I owe him for it. And it's possible he just overlooked it, but I can't use that as an excuse. So I texted him and said, hey, I don't remember ever getting an invoice. I don't see any payment I've ever made for you. So I think you need to invoice me so that I can pay for this. But what pushed me in that direction was going through this and going, huh, I didn't pay the guy that worked for me. Now again, it was an innocent thing. I waited for the invoice to come. I would have paid it. I pay all my bills the day I get them. So I would have done that. But it truly did just drop off my radar, because I expect to get those invoices to remind me that I got stuff to pay. You know, if my credit card bill doesn't come in the mail, I forget that I owe it. So anyway, that's what we're seeing here. The Bible condemns taking advantage of others for our own gain. But the other thing that it does, and James doesn't cover it here specifically, but it fits a biblical principle, is that the Bible encourages us to work so that we have something to give. And that's something that we often forget. Ephesians chapter 4, verse 28. Why don't you turn there with me and we'll wrap it up with this. Ephesians chapter 4. Instead of our pursuit being working to build wealth for ourselves so that we can live a luxurious life without considering what God wants for us, what God chooses for us, instead of pursuing that, what the Bible encourages us to do is to work so that we can have something to give. And that's exactly what Paul says here in Ephesians chapter 4, starting in verse, or just we'll read in verse 28. He who steals must steal no longer. And that would include simply taking advantage. What were these rich doing? They were stealing. That money was not theirs. It was owed to their workers. So by withholding it, they were stealing. And Paul writes, he who steals must steal no longer. But rather, he must work, performing with his own hands what is good, doing good labor, right? Why? So he can take care of his bills. Isn't that what it says? Is that what your version says? Am I missing something? What does it say? Somebody shout it out. Oh, interesting. So that he will have something to share with one who has need. So why do we work? Just to pay our own bills? Just so we can build our own storehouses and have the fancy cars and the big house? And again, nothing wrong with those things. But here's, I'm going to throw something out, and maybe this will get me in trouble, I don't know. If we work, and even if we work appropriately, we're diligent, and all we have is enough for those things, have we met the biblical standard of why we work? What's the biblical standard? Why we work? So that you have something to share. Does that sting a little bit? If we work, even if we're diligent, even if we're not living off the backs of others, even if nothing we're doing about the way that we're building our wealth would be considered to be sinful or wrong, if all of that simply goes to feed our own lifestyle, and we don't have enough to be able to give and to help those in need, have we met the biblical standard? It's a yes, no question. We're a little bit reluctant to answer that, aren't we?
Ways of sharing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not just money, but, you know,
time, energy, clothing. Right. Yeah. Yep. But the principle is we work not just to build wealth, to have things, not just to take care of our needs, but so that we can help those who can't. Because there are those who can't. Legitimately. And they need help and they need support. And that's something that we do in our own heart, right? The Bible doesn't tell us you got to give X percent to do that specifically thing there, right? It just simply says work that you might have something to give. And so that's the bigger principle. And so it's also, I think, the antidote to what James is confronting them on. It's interesting, if your heart is, man, I want to work in a way that God can use my gifts and abilities so that I might be able to generate enough so that I can help. It's really hard to think about yourself, isn't it? Because your focus is on that. You know, and you mentioned a good point. I've got certain skills when it comes to IT stuff. It comes really easy to me. I'm fairly intuitive with it, you know. And sometimes more often than others, but quite often, I'll use those abilities to help somebody out so that they don't have to call the Geek Squad. And I won't charge them for it. But I spent a couple weeks ago, I spent probably a grand total of maybe 8 to 10 hours helping out an older gentleman in the neighborhood whose laptop died. He lost all his documents, and so I worked on that. I helped him with that. I helped him buy a new one, helped get everything transferred over. I think all told, I was in about 10 hours. And he pulled out his wallet and said, here, take whatever you want out of this. And I pushed the wallet back, and I said, no, it doesn't. He's like, well, I got to pay you for your time. I said, no, you don't. I had the skills and abilities. I didn't need the income. But that fits into that category as well. God has gifted us with certain abilities and other things. And so, yeah, giving clothes. You know, delivering food. A number of years ago, Amy and I, there was a woman in the neighborhood who developed cancer, I think it was. We brought a couple bags of groceries, took them down to the family. Why? We worked so we could have something to give. So I think our takeaway for this, maybe we don't fall into the picture of, I don't have any employees I'm ripping off. Maybe I don't even live luxuriously by American standards. Maybe by third world standards we really do. But maybe by American standards, we don't all live in a big house with lots of toys and a lot of stuff. And again, nothing wrong with that. The Bible doesn't condemn it. So what do? We just ignore this passage? No, because again, the principle is, don't do that. But that's not where the standard stops. Because again, the Bible tells us, work so that you can give. Amen?